We've talked to Professor Yolanda Van Heesick from Otago University's Department of Zoology before about sightings of big cats in the South Island, always an entertaining topic. But most of us have small cats, if we have cats, and most of us don't regularly go out into the big habitats they'd have to inhabit. And when we think of biodiversity, it's often on a big scale as well. But we can do it at home. This is a project with funding from MB called Garden Star. Dr. Yolanda Van Heesick, kia ora to you. Nice to have you back on.
Kia ora, Jim. It's lovely to be back on.
You and your research team have been investigating the important role private gardens can play in contributing to biodiversity. We may look out the window, many of us, and think we don't have much potential to change a lot. But in fact, all our gardens together constitute our biggest urban green space. What is the statistic on that in Dunedin, for example?
Well, in Dunedin, we have measured that. It wasn't my study, but it comes to 36% of the urban area, which is really big. Probably a bit less than that in Auckland, because there's more medium density housing. But even in really big cities like London or Glasgow, it's somewhere between about 22 and 27%. So it is a really significant proportion.
Yeah, and impressive and important. So I'll ask you about the biodiversity evaluation tool you've devised for Garden Star and the rating system that goes with it. But you mean it to apply to everyone from, you know, people who need ride-on mowers to people with window boxes, basically?
Pretty much. I guess you would need to have some form of a garden at the moment for us to be able to apply the tool that we've developed. But having said that, next year we're hoping to look at how we can further develop the tool to apply to a more built environment. So that would apply to, say, people living in apartments that might have balconies, well, and the buildings themselves too. Like, it's possible to you know, create buildings that do have more biodiversity associated with them.
Okay. Garden Star certification ratings in the same way we have Home Star ratings. That's the idea?
Yeah, because the Home Star rating, of course, reflects the sustainability of your home, and I think it's been quite successful. I suspect that the rating is actually on the LIM report for Auckland houses. So we thought, well, if we want to try to motivate homeowners or householders and incentivize them to improve the biodiversity in their gardens, maybe we could come up with a Garden Star scheme where they can get their garden evaluated, and that could be given, say, a star rating, but also lots of information to show them how we got to that rating, and also what they could do if they wanted to improve their rating. What we'd like to work on is to get councils interested in adopting the scheme, and maybe the councils could also provide some incentives to engage in the scheme as well.
The new builds in our bigger cities to squeeze more people in, the intensifying of the built environments in places like Auckland, does that limit attempts to make our environments greener? I mean, some developers will create little green oases, and some, I imagine, will not.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But I think that in New Zealand, on the whole, we're not very good at developments that do allow space for biodiversity, and we could be doing this much better. Other people in other countries have done it better, and we can certainly do a lot better than what we're doing at the moment.
Yeah, I'll get to the overseas examples, but locally, impermeable surfaces, they're an issue. I mean, I don't know if councils have adopted a more relaxed attitude towards them or not, but you do seem to see quite a few places now with a lot of concrete laid down.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something which anyone can do. You know, you don't need a permit usually to extend your drive, for example. And the increase in hard landscaping, which is usually patios or concreted drives, it's just ongoing all the time. It reduces habitat for all the other species that want to live in urban areas as well.
You and your experts have identified the features of private gardens that are indicative of biodiversity, and there are quite a few of them. Can you tell us about the software you use to rank them, please?
We had a group of nearly 20 people who were contributing their expertise in this particular exercise, and yeah, they came up with over 160 features, so we had to sort of collapse them. But then, yeah, as you said, we had to kind of give them weightings So we had four main categories. One was the extent of the habitat, so, you know, what proportion of your property is actually permeable. And then there was the quality of the habitat on that, and that was the kind of vegetation it was supporting. But there was also the management, and that's how the householder actually, the sort of things they do, whether they use a lot of pesticides or whether they have a free-roaming cat or whether they've created special things like encourage birds and lizards and invertebrates. And then the fourth was kind of like the context, the landscape context. So in applying weightings for these, we used a very cool bit of software called 1000 Minds. It's designed to help people make choices between two alternatives that are trade-offs. Habitat quality came out as having the biggest weightings.
Alternatives would be, for example, a cat versus lizards, because cats
I mean, it took a whole team of people who are experts on this topic some time to actually go through that process themselves. So if Garden Star was taken up by councils, then the way that we would see it best applied would be in the form of an app, so that people could use the app and pretty much rate their garden themselves. That app could link them to the information that they needed to actually make improvements.
You put the software to the test. How did you do that?
I think it was about 90 gardens across Dunedin and the Wakatipu Basin. And, we came up with some really good data, and we could see how we might need to tweak the process to make it a bit more smoothly. But we were very happy with the results. And so we feel that it's at a point now where we could be applying it.
There was interest among the people in Dunedin and the Wakatipu Basin in this. They were quite keen when their gardens were evaluated.
Yeah, they were very keen, and we didn't have any trouble recruiting people into the study, and we provided everyone with feedback. So we were very happy with the way that the pilot ran, and like I said, we feel that it's ready to go if someone wants to take it up. Maybe if there's someone from a council who's listening to this program, then I'd be very happy for them to get in touch with me.
You've looked at overseas solutions in cramped environments, like vertical forests, for example. Well, they're pretty spectacular, but even little vertical gardens, they can all play a role.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's lots of different bits and pieces of the urban built environment that can play a role. Like the vertical forests are kind of the spectacular ones that are at one end of that spectrum. I mean, that one that you might have seen, that's from Milan, and it's two apartment buildings that actually have something like 800 trees planted on balconies, and they have thousands of shrubs and plants, and it really is a vertical forest. At a more modest scale, we can achieve a lot more with green roofs and green walls, and there's lots of small spaces that we can plant things as well.
Yeah, indeed. So what can the average homeowner or home renter, for that matter, do? What sorts of things? I noticed, for example, clustering of trees and shrubs. Why?
Well, that was because a lot of people have a lawn and there's just one tree in the middle of it. And for other animals, invertebrates or birds, obviously the tree has value, but you immediately increase the value of that tree a lot if it has some shrubs underneath it. And if you have these kind of clusters which are not too far apart, then those form kind of like stepping stones for species that it helps them navigate around areas which might be much less attractive, just like a bare lawn.
Okay. How do you make a bug hotel?
Even at shops like Mitre 10 or Bunnings, you can pick up bug hotels that they don't cost a lot. New Zealand native bees, that they're not colonial like the honeybees. They often nest in these little burrows in the ground, so or on something else, on banks. So some of those things that you can buy are geared towards species like that, that just need to have their own little hole to go into.
As we all do. Lizards. Yeah. Lizards are thriving in Auckland environments. They like piles of rocks, don't they?
They do like piles of rocks, but probably the most abundant species in Auckland, lizard species, is the plague skink, which is likely to be the one that most people notice. And that's actually an invasive species from Australia. and they have the potential to completely outcompete your native lizards. But it is true that there are some good populations of native lizards in Auckland, but you know, they're also suffering from tidy gardens and ongoing human development and also mammalian predators. So those piles of rocks are actually quite important because they are a refuge that the lizards can get into. But even then, you know, mice eat lizards, and so the piles of rocks, if the gaps in them are big enough to let mice in, then the lizards won't be safe there either.
Feeding birds sugar water in winter. A lot of people do, but a lot of people never think of that, eh?
Yeah, they don't think of it. It's a fantastic way to get birds to come to your garden. I mean, I have a sugar feeder up, and we just have tui there the whole time, bell birds and silver eyes as well. And what's interesting is that house sparrows, which of course are not native and they're primarily grain feeders, are also very clever. They're very good at adapting to urban environments, and they've started to drink sugar water out of sugar feeders as well, which I think is quite funny.
Feeding birds generally, what's your opinion about that, Yolanda?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's been a couple of studies done up in Auckland that led by Margaret Stanley at the University of Auckland, trying to identify whether there are negative impacts from bird feeding. There can be pathogens, and imagine a lovely sugary solution that could attract a lot of bacteria. And also, because it has the effect of congregating birds around a feeder, that it can potentially increase disease transmission. The most recent research done by a PhD student, Daria Aristova, showed, well, she didn't find any really strong evidence for disease transmission among the birds that were visiting sugar water feeders. But she also didn't find a lot of evidence that by feeding in the sugar water feeders that the birds were in better condition. So I think in countries like the UK, people often feed birds because they have very harsh winters and they feel like they're helping birds through the winter. But maybe in New Zealand, where our winters aren't so harsh, bird feeders, well, they're not really important for supporting birds and helping them to survive, but they're used more because people just like to have them in their garden so that they can see them.
Yeah, that's true. But you don't need to put a whole lot of white bread out there to save the birds in the winter.
Probably not, no. And I think there has been some evidence that suggests that bread feeding is associated with some disease transmission.
Increasing native ground cover, just finally. If you don't have much room and you can't plant a karaka or a kowhai, there are smaller options, and some of the natives suit pots, don't they?
Yes, certainly. I mean, there's a lot of small native species that you can plant, and it's good to have ground cover, and part of our Garden Star evaluation tool actually looks at the amount of ground cover and actually cover at different levels. So even though trees are great, but we're also interested in all those other layers as well.
Good luck with Garden Star, and do let us know if you get uptake from councils, if you get a few phone calls. That would be good.
I will. Thank you. Thanks very much, Jim.
Well, if I was just going to say, if you end up with shrubbery that's dense and luxuriant enough, you might even attract big cats. Big cats, Yolanda.
Yes, you might. They might use it as cover to pounce on the birds that are visiting your feeders. Yeah.
Hey, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.